The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The structure of the becoming. All right? You had the will, goal, plan, the principles of organization, and then you have the particular activity itself. All right? That correlates to the crown of the yud, the yud, the hey, the vav, and the hey. This is the structure of the becoming. We understand that life is a movement, a development, a growth. Okay, there's ups and downs, but in general, everything is moving forward. Okay, and up. All right? And this is the structure of it. Our life challenge is to coordinate our individual life to what we would call, you know, the universal cosmic life, the movement of all. And so, as we mentioned last time we got together, which was last week, life is like a symphony. Okay, each and every one of us has our roles and our pieces that we are to play, our instruments, and the goal is to coordinate and to experience a harmonious life. Okay, a mitzvah is an act which guarantees a harmony between myself and the movement of history and life and so forth. A sin, however, a transgression, sets out dissonance. Dissonance. Okay? Also probably dissonance too. Dissonance, there's a certain dis-ease going on. Okay? I'm not coordinated with life. Alright? In simple language, it's called making your will as God's will. Coordinating your will to God's will. Alright? That's simply what a mitzvah is. God wants me to do it, I choose to do it. It's done, and there is a relationship of coordination and synchronization between my will and the divine will. And the high experience that one can achieve is there's a moment when you're playing in a symphony, and as you coordinate yourself more and more to that symphony, you begin to experience the entire symphony as part of your personal definition. You don't experience yourself as this individual and a collection of individuals, but you actually experience yourself as an individual to the inclusion of the entire symphony. You almost feel like the whole symphony is playing through you, even though you're simply a violin player, you're a trombone player, you're a tuba player. But somehow, as an individual, I experience the whole within myself. Okay? The whole within myself. Alright. Now there's another model that we can use to explain this, and this is something that we can draw from something called holistic biology. I don't think I talked about holistic biology with you, did I? Okay. So there are two schools of thought in biology. One which is called reductionism, and one which is called holistic biology. Okay, now according to reductionism, if I want to understand something, then what do? I reduce it to its most basic building block. So I reduce it down to something. All right? So if I want to understand a muscle, how would I understand it? It's by reducing it to a cell. Right? And somehow, once I explore the cell, then I kind of tally it all up, put it together, and that would somehow give some understanding of the whole muscle. You follow? All right. That was reductionism. There's a whole new school of thought. It's not so new anymore. And, of course, it came out of California. It's called holistic biology. Now, holistic biology has a completely different approach. You cannot understand the whole muscle by reducing it to its constituent parts. Okay? Why? For a simple fact that the whole is actually greater than the sum of the parts. Okay? The whole is not equal to the sum of the parts, but rather the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. More than that. What they claim in holistic biology is that there's this whole character, okay, to the organism that establishes certain principles of organization that guides the process in a manner that brings about the revelation or the fruition of the holistic character. Let me give you an example so you understand this. Now, this is what they found in embryology. Let's say they were experimenting with the evolving process of a chicken. Okay? So you have this chicken.
Right? Where this chicken is, nobody knows. There's this holistic character called chicken. This holistic character establishes principles of organization, all right, which guides the process of this evolving chicken towards the fulfillment of this chicken. And it can happen in many different ways. Okay? It can happen, you might have, you know, this outer development of the chicken. Okay? You might have this outer development whereby the external shell of the chicken fills in as it moves towards the inside. They found that some chickens would develop from the middle, so to speak, and evolve outside. Some would start with the toes and move up. In other words, there's just like infinite ways it could happen, and yet in the end, what happened was El Chico. Okay? That's what would happen. You would have a chicken at the end of this whole process. So therefore, the way they would describe it is that somewhere, of course, that's very abstract, there's this holistic character. Okay, holistic character. This holistic character establishes principles of organization which directs the particular activity towards the fulfillment of this holistic character. Do you understand? In other words, it's just the same thing we just did on the board. But they're finding it to be true in biology, all right? That there's some kind of will, you know, that says, so it shall be. Okay, fine. And what shall be? This holistic character. In this case, it's chicken, okay? Now, this holistic character cannot be found in any particular place. That's what they, you know, because the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Not a function of the parts. In fact, the parts are a function of this whole. This abstract whole exists. And it's seeking to be fulfilled. It's seeking to be expressed and manifest. And it sets up these certain principles. These principles govern the process, but the mystery of it is it governs the process in a manner which is free. In other words, imagine that you and I are atoms, or cells, in a chicken, an evolving chicken. Now, of course, you and I don't know this, right? We don't know this. But what we experience in our lives, you're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing. We never in a million years thought that whatever we're doing had any impact on anybody else around. You know, you're building your yacht and I'm building my estate and you're fixing your motorcycle. And we're all doing various random activities which seem to have absolutely no connection between us, right? And then there's this smart atom. You know, a smart aleck atom, that says, you know what, I think that there is some kind of thematic principle to our histories. And that even though we all kind of feel like our activities are very random and disconnected and fragmented, I really think that somehow, in a way that we ourselves don't even realize, we're contributing to some greater plan that is actually becoming fulfilled through us, then some way each and every one of us, without knowing, are somewhat instruments of this theme, and it's playing through us. Now, a number of us, atoms, think he's a nut. You know, oh, gee, you're crazy. But this guy is just bent on, just absolutely committed to proving his point. And he develops this contraption, some, you know, rocket ship, whatever, and he gets out of the scene and he starts taking pictures how, in fact, every single one of us was contributing to the development of a cosmic chicken. Right? And you thought you were just building your yard, but you were, in fact, building the beak. And you thought you had nothing to do with me, but you were fixing your motorcycle, but in fact, it was completing the feat. And so on and so forth. And what happens as we go on, that there's actually this pattern that we're completely unaware of, that we have been contributing all along. Do you follow this? Now, we'd have a very interesting experience in our lives. We, on one hand, sense that life is free. On the other hand, we'd feel that life has a very clear fate to it. We'd experience that, on one hand, I lead my life, but there would be times where I kind of feel like the only way to describe it is life leads me. Right? I'm sure you've experienced that yourself in your own life, where you've made this choice to go, I don't know, to India, and yet somehow you ended up in Israel by some bizarre, you know, events that got you there. And so sometimes you felt like you made that choice and you got to where you were going because you made that choice. And sometimes you feel no matter what choice you made, somehow where you were supposed to be, you end up being.
I'm sure you've experienced that in your life. It kind of goes beyond this dichotomy or this paradox between free choice and determinism. Sometimes the deterministic element of our lives becomes more apparent, and sometimes the choice aspect of our life becomes more apparent. But the truth is that life is beyond the either or, as is it free choice or is it determined? And so we move along, and without knowing, we are somehow contributing to life process, the theme of life. Now that attitude is in fact quite consistent with the Jewish attitude. In other words, that God has a plan, and we are players in that plan, and the question isn't whether we're going to contribute to the plan, because the fact is we definitely are contributing. The question is whether we know we're contributing. Alright? Whether we realize we're contributing. Whether we choose a path that clearly aligns itself up with the movement of life and directly facilitates it in a way that we can see it, we can feel it, we can know it, we can taste it, we can be conscious of what we're really part of. Or we could choose a lifestyle that seems absolutely oblivious of any kind of theme happening in our lives. Okay? Any kind of movement. Oblivious that we're really part of a symphony no matter what we think, and that it's ridiculous to think that a tuba player could have any meaning as a soloist. Okay? But rather, as a tuba player, I'm part of a symphony. I seek to coordinate my life to the symphony of life. Alright. So now.
So wait, so you're saying the holistic is the Judaism way?
Yes. Right. Right. Which we're going to talk about in a second. A little bit more. So, what's the significance of choice? See, on one hand, when you look at holistic biology, it seems to be suggesting that there's a clear direction, a goal, a plan, what's going to be is going to be. But how that's going to happen is really your choice. That's one of the basic ways of understanding Judaism. That what's going to happen, the Jewish people are coming back to the land of Israel? Yes, indeed. Mashiach's coming? Certainly. But to what extent will I be a participant in that? To what extent will I be aware of that? That's my choice. In other words, this is well illustrated in the story of the Megillah, the Purim story. Because Esther has, in a strange way, become functionally the queen. You know, married to this king. And, okay, rotten, good-for-nothing bum Haman, okay, has decided to destroy the Jewish people. All right, fine. Now, Esther's uncle, Mordechai, he says, "Wow, my gosh, we've got to save the Jewish people." And he calls out to Esther. He says, "Esther, this is your choice. Perhaps it's for this very reason that Hashem has orchestrated things in such a manner that you're in this position to help the Jewish people." Okay? Now, Esther originally responded not so positive. She said, "Hey, if I go to the king, right, without being invited, he could cut my head off. And I wouldn't want to lose my pretty head. And so it would be very frightening." Okay? She doesn't want to do it. Now Mordechai says something even more bizarre. He says, "Listen, Esther, if you don't do this, then the Yeshua, the salvation of the Jewish people, will come from somewhere else." Now that doesn't sound like a very inspiring way to get somebody to do something. You would think, "Esther, if you don't do this, it's not going to happen. Esther, if you don't do this, then who knows what tragedies may befall the Jewish people. This may in fact be the end of Jewish history." He doesn't say that. Which would make more sense that that's what you say. Because if you want to excite a person, make them feel somewhat guilty, somewhat responsible, then you tell them that if you don't do it, it's not going to get done. That's not what he says. He says, "If you don't do it, somebody else will do it." And you know what's even more amazing? At that point, she decides to do it. She completely transforms. She decides, "Oh, okay, fine. All right, so let's go." And she starts bossing everybody around. "You do this, you do that, you do this, you do that." And she becomes incredibly active. It's a very strange thing. You see, what Mordechai was telling her is the basic Jewish idea. The salvation of the Jewish people is going to come no matter what. Your choice is, do you want to have a role in it? Do you want to actively, consciously participate in it? And that will be, in fact, your reward. That you were part of that. You enjoyed to be a facilitator. You enjoyed the possibility of being a partner in the redemption of the Jewish people. And if you don't, so it'll happen, but you lose out. Jewish history won't lose out, because someone else will do it. Because it's got to happen, and it will happen. Okay? But do you want to facilitate that redemptive process? That's really your choice. All right? Yes, Naomi.
Yeah, so if you're saying that In some ways, does it take away from the law side, the commandment side of halakha? It's saying, well, you know, you can do whatever you want, but the Jews are going to be celebrated anyway. But it's saying that basically no Jews really have to follow halakha because there's going to be salvation anyway. I mean,
that's right. It gives halakha even more importance, okay? Because not only because you have the choice to follow it, because now it really makes a difference to you, okay? It really makes a difference to you qualitatively what your life is going to be like, how you are going to experience being part of history or whether you're going to feel like you're not part of history, right? So it has an immediate impact on you. If you think that, well, if I keep halakha, then somehow, if I don't keep halakha, I'm going to undermine the whole system of God and, God's plan won't happen. God's plan will happen, you just won't be part of it. Okay? Because you've just cut yourself out of the scene. You've just basically cut yourself out of history by not being part of it. Which is the very reward. The reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. Right? The mitzvah is the possibility to be a partner in this process. Okay? If you want to be a partner, you will. If you don't want to, so you won't. But who loses out? You lose out. And the community loses out because there are many ways that this process can happen. That's our choice. Okay, we choose to be part of it, and how we want to be part of it. So in other words, you know, there used to be this game, I'm sure there still is this game, okay, it was called Concentration. And in this game, Concentration, you have these markers that are covered up, alright, and over here we have a colored television set. And then over here you've got a banana. Okay, and over here you have, yes sir, a Rolls Royce. Okay? Okay, whatever. And you got all these other interesting things, flowers and whatever. This stuff is strong. Great stuff. Okay, so, question is like this. So you don't know what's behind these cards. You don't know if it's behind any of this. But you now have to make a choice. And there's two people playing against each other. One says, oh, I want a card A, B. Okay, fine. I'm sorry. What A? Turn around, a television set. Ooh, now can he find or can she find that television? Oh, I saw that television set. I saw the television. Wait, is it 4D? Turn around, television set. And so what do? They take the television set and they open up and what do you see? Nothing. Just a little bit of this. Now, of course, the game goes on and somebody's got to guess what's really behind all this. Right? Now, it could be excruciating, right? The whole time I could think it's a horse. Nope. It's an ant. Nope. And who knows how long this could go on before we realize what it truly is. Now, there's certain cards here that are just absolutely critical. Right? If that card goes, then the chance of me figuring out what this is all about is much easier. Alright? Well, so too, the way life goes. There's a plan to history. There's a movement to history. How the particular scenes fall, the organization of it, is in your hands. But what will finally happen, right, is in God's hands. Now you choose, number one, whether you're going to be an active subject, conscious of having a role in history that has a theme, that is serving a godly mission, so to speak, or whether you're going to choose a lifestyle that is completely divorced of that, has nothing to do with it, in fact, leads you to think that life has a completely different theme. All right? And what is the final point of all this? The final point of this is Olam Haba, the world to come. Because what will happen? Did anybody see the Planet of the Apes? Right? So there's a fantastic scene over there. The whole time these guys land and they find themselves in a primitive world, you know, and these are only ape men, you know, and everything, and we gotta run, we gotta get out of here, so they're trying to get out of there, and so they start running for their vehicle, their space vehicle, whatever it was. And then all of a sudden, as they're trying to get out of the past, all of a sudden what do they see? The Statue of Liberty. And they realize that they went into the future. Okay, now that's shock. Wow! You know, the last scene retroactively redefines everything that was happening. Okay? And so too, these great suspense stories whereby the whole time you thought it was the butler, right? And it's just in the last 2 minutes that you realize it was the 5-year-old kid who did it. You know, and like, wow. And it's, all of a sudden, everything makes sense. You want to see that movie 5 times to figure out how, in fact, every move was completely misread by the audience. Okay? But every move was, in fact, really building up to that final moment where we realize it was the kid who did it. You know, we can create life into such a thriller, but a very agonizing thriller, where we have absolutely no understanding, no sense whatsoever what's really going on here. Right? What's really going on? Who is the villain? What's the theme? Is there a theme? Okay? That's somewhat like what they call future shock. All right? We talked a little bit about, you know, heaven and hell. So too, depending on how you orchestrate your life, will determine how you'll perceive it afterwards, or what your reaction will be when you reach the next world. Because in the next world, all the cards will fall and you'll see what the real theme of life was all about. Now, depending on how you kind of staged your life, will determine whether that realization afterlife will be a pleasant one, a confirming one, a beautiful one, or whether it will be just absolutely excruciating. Why? So one of the examples that's brought down, in fact, is that it says that God in the future will reveal the hidden light. Okay? God took the sun, the oral tradition says, and hid it, concealed it. Alright? In the future, God will reveal this light. The righteous will just bask in it. Fantastic. But the evil will be burnt by it. Now, that's interesting. The same light, for some, will be horrifying, and for some, will be absolutely ecstasy. How's it possible that the same light could have such different experiences for such different people? You see, it all has to do with how you orchestrate your life, and whether you've orchestrated your life and adopted a theme of life which coordinates to what genuinely is the theme of life. So imagine, for instance, as a person, and this guy is an accountant. He is the top accountant in Manhattan. He's got a fantastic position, making just so much money, in a wonderful office, feeling tremendous prestige. All right. What happens is, his whole life was based on his brains, his incredible memory. You know, if someone could ask him a question in tax laws or whatever, or the accounting reports of the company going back 50 years, it's like that fresh in his mind. He could just knock it off for you. And he really feels very proud. He feels very comfortable. He feels very worthy, right? Okay? Very valuable person. Well, what happens is, one day they knock on his door, you know, the guy's name is Bert. So they say, Bert, we've got some bad news for you. So he says, yeah, well, what is it? Well, the company's taking a whole new move. And, there's basically no more room for you here, Bert. Guy's in shock. What? What do you mean, no more room for me? How could that be? I mean, I'm the best accountant in all of Manhattan. I mean, what are you laying me off? Well, sorry, Bert, but, you know, things are changing and you're being replaced. What do you mean I'm being replaced? You just said I'm being laid off. What do you mean now you're telling me I'm being replaced? Well, who's replacing me? Well, what they do is they take out of their pocket this tiny little computer and they put it on his desk. And the computer goes, good morning. And the guy's in shock, right? What? That computer is going to replace me? How is that possible? I mean, what does this computer know? So they push a button, and this computer, within 2 seconds, has just printed out, I don't know, the records of the business for the last 100 years, right? It's shocking, right? He'll be absolutely devastated. That's hell. That's really hell for this person. But then there's another person who was a fantastic accountant, but he never identified or never thought his essence was being an accountant. He never thought, that's me. That's what life is. You know, that's what gives me value as a human being. But he knew that what's really valuable was his relationship with his wife and his kids and the kindness that he would do and the charity that he would do and all that. And now what happens is they come and they say to him, hey, listen, you're being laid off. He says, yeah! You know, really? He says, what's replacing me? He says, this little computer. Thank God! You know, that's great. So I don't have to be here, so I can do the things I love. I'm making a great pension, and I'm fine with it. Right? Because he's absolutely sure that there's one thing this computer cannot do that is uniquely human. This computer might say, good morning, right? But this computer cannot say, I love you. I mean, it could say it, but it couldn't really mean it. Because this computer cannot really fulfill the purpose of relationships, of love. This computer cannot be just or be kind. It cannot be truthful or peaceful or loving or all the other attributes that are uniquely human but are uniquely divine about us. That the computer cannot do. So you see two completely different people based on how they orchestrated their lives, how they viewed things. One will find that computer absolutely shocking. Will absolutely blow them away. Right? And it will be hell. They'll probably go into depression, who knows what. Another person will just be so excited. It's like, fantastic, that's great. Now I'll be free to do the things that are uniquely, specially human about me. That I can do things that are uniquely the ability of a soul. Okay? Wow. That's great. You know, that's just great. So too, the future shock is in the final scene of life, so to speak, revealed will be the light that will tell us what it was really all about. Now for some of us, who had in fact coordinated our lives appropriately to the theme, we'll be only confirmed, that's what I thought life was all about. I know that everything else around us, you know, the media was telling me life is be thin, and then next year was life was being fat, and next year, you know, life is Marlboro Man, and next year it's who knows what, you know, it's Dunkin' Donuts. Whatever it is, but I didn't think that that was the theme of life. And I never really orchestrated, designed my life to make that the theme. Oh, that was very nice, you know, but that wasn't the theme of it. My clothing, my car, my this, my that, that wasn't the theme of it. Right? The theme of it was reaching out to the divine, incorporating divine values and ideals into my life, bringing that presence of God into the world. That was uniquely human. That was uniquely what a human being created in the image of God could do. Alright? So I feel wonderful. But the other person will be absolutely shocked. Depends on how you coordinate your life. So Judaism claims like this. Judaism claims that the Jewish lifestyle, which is based on halakha and mitzvot, coordinates my particular theme in such a way that it properly reflects the theme of life. The path of emunah, which is faith, but it's much deeper than that. The path of emunah is not a path of faith, you know, like I believe. That's not what faith is, emunah. But rather, the path of emunah is the path of successfully portraying what the theme of life is truly all about. The word emunah, which is loosely translated as faith, comes from the word art. Omanut is to be an artist. What is an artist? An artist has this ability to paint the picture of love, right? Has the ability to portray kindness. Portray justice. Like that's where they can take an abstract reality and somehow portray it. Right? So too in our lives is a theme of life. Right? An abstract theme of life. And the path of Evunah is that I successfully portray that in my particular life, in my community. And we all get in touch with, hey, we all sense, yeah, that's what life is all about. Yeah, but it's possible, especially with the media as it is, to convince us of some absolutely other way of what life is all about. You know, that's one of the amazing things about commercials today. For instance, they found that in cigarette commercials, that by putting on the bottom, warning the general surgeon or the surgeon general, whoever that guy is, right, warns that, you know, smoking can be hazardous to your health, right? They found that that promoted cigarettes. Isn't that interesting? And so therefore, legally, it doesn't have to be a certain size. They found, gee, it's helping us. So they made it even bigger. Because they found that people responded well to that. There was this feeling of, yeah, you can be a Marlboro Man. Yeah, you can look life in the face and say, I dare you, God, to give me cancer. Ha! I'm not afraid of you. In other words, they actually found that that made people more interested in it because there was a feeling of death to it. There was a risk to it. It was like, yeah, I'm really strong. I'm really powerful. I'm not afraid of anybody, not even the cigarette over here. And so it's amazing how they found that media can, in fact, by telling you things, it's for you, and you do things that if you had thought about it, you might not want to do that. Alright? But often we don't think about it. And so too, The Zohar talks about a very, very painful experience. And this experience goes like this. We are told that when a person dies, they see their own funeral. Right? In other words, you're at your funeral. Right? Nobody sees you. You see everybody else. Nobody hears you. But you hear everybody else. But you, in spirit, are actually there. Right? Now, again, depending on how you designed your life, will determine how that's going to be experienced. I mean, it's going to be very painful to hear the ones that you love say, oh, I'm glad the old bag left us, and gee, didn't leave us a dime. Yeah, he was a real stingy bum anyways. Oh, you write the eulogy. Oh, I'd rather write a joke. Oh, you know, and that would be very painful. All right? So, in fact, the neshama sees this and realizes who was really my friend, so to speak, and where was I really fooling myself? Okay? But more than that, the neshama sees the body being lowered into the ground. Now that's a really shocking experience because you've been in this body for, God willing, about 120 years. Now this will be shocking to everybody. But depending again how you orchestrated your life will determine whether this will be somewhat of a confirming experience or somewhat of an absolute horrifying experience. Again, the difference is such. If my whole life revolved around my body, you know, I was Mr. Universe five times over, and my whole sense of value was based on my physique. You know, there are pictures all over the place, this, that, and that was, you know, me. Right? That's a very painful thing when you then realize that wasn't you. Right? In goes the body, and it says in the Talmud that the worms to the body are like needles to the deceased. Now, I mean, the deceased is dead, so... No, but basically, I know this sounds pretty gory. We did this, you know, sorry doing it just after lunch, but... basically, that you see these worms eating your body. You see your body being decayed. Now, it all depends on how intensely you identify your very essential I with your body. Okay? And if you, in fact, identified it was all my clothing, my looks, my this, my that, you know, well, then that is going to be just absolutely horrible. Just horrible. But then there's another person who, you know, they took care of their body, they were concerned about their body. Everybody will feel hurt because it's an aspect of themselves, no doubt. But they never really thought that that was the essential I. They never really thought that that was what it was all about, but they identified with more abstract, more eternal things. They identified with the value of love, the value of charity, the value of... And that was what made them feel good about themselves when they did those kinds of things and when they were involved with those kinds of things. And so when a person of that nature who had designed their particular life path in that way, well, then they really coordinate with the real theme of life, and then therefore that experience won't be so devastating. All right. Now there's another experience that's considered to be the horror of horrors, okay? And this is called the Kaf Hakela. The experience is this stone being thrown down a pit, and it goes back and forth, you know, you kind of see it going back and forth from the walls of the pit, you know? So that's the experience of the deceased body. In other words, Kaf Hakela is being caught between two worlds. This is a horrifying experience. Whereas you die, but you actually don't leave this world. You can't get into the next world, but you're basically no longer really in this world. Do you follow this? You want to see ghosts? That's what I heard ghosts is all about.
But anyways, is it true that Judaism believes in this?
Yes, and a Jew wrote that, that play Ghost. But anyways, friends of my friends. But anyways, the point is like this. I don't know if he took it from Judaism, but the idea is that a person has been totally, totally identified their identity with this worldly things. Alright? And when they die, they simply can't let go. Because that's their essential I. They've made that their essential I. On the other hand, they have died. They are dead. And therefore, they're not in this physical world. Now, they haven't done enough mitzvot. You know, they haven't identified enough with the abstract realm, the conceptual realm, the holy realm, to get them out of this world. On the other hand, they did die. And so now they're trapped between two worlds. They're not in this world because they don't have a body. They can't get in the next world because they really didn't because they're so identified still with this world, they simply can't let go of this world. Whenever I talk about this, I always think of these cartoons when I was a kid. Sylvester the cat, he's going after Tweety Bird, and then he jumps and he makes a mistake and he's falling, and all of a sudden you see, you know, just the, you know, like you see the lines of his paws as they're kind of being. That's it. You know, you can't let go. This, by the way, is what the Talmud says, that the righteous, when they die, their soul leaves like hair being pulled out of cream. Right? It's a smooth, easy transition to the next world. But the evil is like cotton being pulled out of a thorn bush. Okay? They just can't let go. Because everything they did in their lives, was everything about themselves, was so invested in their money, their looks, their property, their car. Okay? That was so much them. And there was nothing else. I mean, oh, of course they do a mitzvah here or there. But they didn't really base their life in any higher way. And they simply can't get out. Now, what does this person do? It's a horrifying experience. They're in this world, and yet they're out of this world. Alright, so what do they have to do? So this is where you get the whole idea of the dibbuk. Alright? This soul must find a body. Alright? This soul is looking for a body to possess, to inhabit. So that this soul can either get back in this world, or get into a physical mode so that he can do a mitzvah to get him out of this world. Alright? Now these are very strong mystical ideas. There is a book called the dibbuk. I know there's a play, but there is a book which deals with it's a documentary on various exorcisms in Judaism. Now, when I was getting involved in Judaism, I remember distinctly sitting in this kosher pizzeria in Toronto, and these guys just came in from seeing The Exorcist. How many people here saw The Exorcist? Aren't you lucky? Okay, so you saw The Exorcist with the green vomit and all that kind of stuff. Okay, and so I'm sitting there having my pizza, and these two yeshiva guys walk in, and they're cracking up laughing. So we went to see The Exorcist. Oh, yeah, what's that all about? He says, oh, it's so stupid. No, it's just, thank God, it's not like that in Judaism. So he says, not like that in Judaism at all? Nah. Anyway, surprise, surprise, years later I find out that there is exorcisms in Judaism. Now, none of this turning that, you know, around and vomit and all that kind of stuff. But the Chafetz Chaim did an exorcism, the Ari did an exorcism, and in this book, the Dibbuk, is documented these various situations in history where a great rabbi had to do an exorcism. What is that? That a soul has possessed this body. Okay? Now, where did all that go? It went to insane asylums. Now, people just go crazy and people don't know what got into them. Right? Well, so now, clinically, oh, they went nuts. Okay? But who knows? There's very serious spiritual things happening in the world. And so, in fact...
It's not witchcraft.
It's not witchcraft. You have to get a great holy rabbi to do it if, in fact, this person is possessed by a soul. Okay? And there's some very... In fact, a friend of mine wrote a play based on an accurate account of the Ari doing exorcism. It was frightening. I don't know who's going to be willing to produce this play. Really frightening play. But it was based on real material. How the Ari, Rav Isaac Luria, performed an exorcism because someone was possessed. So there's a soul that the whole life of this person was so invested, so identified with this world that they simply couldn't leave this world. And yet they do die. And so they can't leave it, and yet they're not out of it, and yet they're not in it. And this is, they look for a body. Now, how do you become a vulnerable victim for one of these souls? The only way one of these souls can get into you is if you identify with their position. And that's through being in a state of, so to speak, sin and transgression. That's what the Kabbalah teaches. That when a person is, you know, in a state of transgression, and they're, so to speak, disconnected from the real theme of life, so they are prime targets for these souls floating around. There's probably a couple million in this room right now. They're looking around while I, you know, try to get back into this world through somebody's body. It's really freaky stuff. Anyways, I made it up. Let's go on. I'm just joking. Okay, now it's serious stuff. Serious stuff. Yeah.
In the first class, you mentioned reincarnation as part of Jewish mysticism.
Right.
Doesn't this appear contradicted?
No. I tell you what. There are basically a number of choices. You know, there's door number one, door number two, door number four. As you die, which would you choose? Now, door number one is ticket straight to what's called Gan Eden. The soul is able to get out of here. The soul goes to this dimension of consciousness whereby it becomes rejuvenated, so to speak, by the mitzvot that it did during its life. Which, unfortunately, as we mentioned before, the body kind of obstructs the energy and the pleasure one should be getting from doing mitzvot. And when we do it, we feel good because we've convinced ourselves, yeah, it's great to put on tefillin. Oh yeah, I feel wonderful doing tzedakah. But we don't get the same kind of immediate gratification as we do when we eat a pizza. Okay? Because the body somehow has an extra sense right now, a predominant sense in our lives right now. That's door number one. Now, door number two is, you didn't quite make it into this dimension called Gan Eden, and so what you do is you go to hell. But hell is only a temporary situation. It's a process of purification, and you could maximally be there for 12 months. That's why when a person dies and we do Kaddish, we do just less than 12 months, not to even suggest that we think that they might be in hell longer than that. Okay? In other words, hell is not eternal for the Jewish people. There's a dimension of consciousness that the soul goes to that that is a purification process. Alright? And that's actually pretty good. If you make it to this, so to speak, hell, you're doing actually pretty good. Alright? Because then the third door is much worse than the first two. First is the best, you know, second choice. Third choice is you come back. Okay? Which is called reincarnation. Which is you have not finished your job. That's you've got something to do. What?
That's sometimes why babies die young, because it still came back.
Sometimes all you needed was that one experience where you came into the body of a baby and you died 2 minutes after your birth. And that was all you needed to complete the process of your consciousness, your journey of consciousness, and that's what you go through. Or you might be reincarnated into an autistic child. And I think I mentioned to you that they've been doing these experiments where they found that these children are brilliant. Right? Somebody developed a way of communicating with these children through computers or something, and these children are saying absolutely amazing, genius things that they, you know, and they realize that this is a very lofty soul. But the soul is coming into this form of life, this mode of life, because of the various consciousness benefits that going through that kind of experience is going to have for that soul. So, but now, that's reincarnation. That's behind door number three. Okay, now, behind door number four, okay, door number four is you get stuck between two worlds. You get caught. You can't get into Gan Eden. You can't even get to hell. You can't even be reincarnated. You haven't even been able to get out of this world enough time to get back into it appropriately. So you're really stuck between these two worlds. You're caught between two worlds. And that's Dibbuk. That the soul looks for, you know, a appropriate boat. Dibbuk? Yeah. Yeah. Comes from Lidavek, which means to cleave to. This clings. This soul, so to speak, clings to you. Tries to find a unexpected, unsuspecting victim. And then this soul gets into the body, and hopefully to try and do a mitzvah to kind of get out of here, or maybe to try and stay here. But hopefully the soul at this point has gotten the message that defining my essential I in terms of this world is not the eternal path. It's not the path to eternal identity. So those are basically the four choices. Come on down, let's make a deal. Yes.
So a person who has that soul early, I have two questions. First of all, is it so bad? And also then he has two eternal eyes.
No, it's just temporary. If this soul is able to do a mitzvah while in this body, then at that point it'll give it enough to get either reincarnated or to hell or whatever. Okay, but it's got to get out of this door number four. Okay? Could be. I don't know. I mean, they've got all kinds of explanations why this and I don't know. You know, all clinical psychology. But there's going to be a point where they're going to have to deal with the soul. I think they're becoming more and more aware of it. That, you know, this guy, many masters, many lives. Okay? They're finding more and more that, I think I told you this, that they hypnotized this woman and she started speaking French. She started speaking this old dialectic of French. What's going on?
Yeah, there's a movie about that.
Called Deadline?
Dead Again.
Anyways, the whole idea is that this woman under a hypnotic trance started to speak French, but she doesn't know any French.
That was she didn't know French. So he hypnotized her and she started to speak French. Now how's that possible? You know, how's that possible? So there's very, I don't know if that's in that particular book. That was an article that I read once upon a time ago. Anyways, look at, so the question is like this. There's a movement, there's a theme, there's a play. Okay? There is a God play. Alright? And each and every one of us has a character, play a character in the play. But, you know, the question is whether we'll play that character, understanding what my role is, coordinating with the director, the producer, having a sense of what I'm really facilitating, what aspect of reality I am revealing in this world, or whether I'm just going to say, there's no play, there's no theme, there's no lines, there's no stage, there's no X, who says I should stand there, and I'm not willing to take any directions in my life. Aggression, all that kind of stuff. Not a good idea.
But Judaism does believe in that.
100%. The Ari told his students why he had about 10 students, and he explained to each one what all their past lives were and why now they're all students of him. You know, and what each one needed to get from the other one in their journey of consciousness, in their journey of realization, in their growth. And so, what can I say? If I'm not willing to take directions, if I'm not willing to say, hey, you know, all the world is stage and all the men and women are merely players in it, but merely is a bad, you know, it kind of diminishes the role. This character is facilitating an expression of a divine truth. Each and every one of us, each scene we play. The question is, am I willing to see it that way, or I'm not willing to see it that way? Okay? And if I'm not willing to see it that way, when in fact I do see it that way, I will be truly embarrassed, and it will be a shocking experience when I realize how I could have lived my life in coordination to what it's all about. Okay?
I have a question about reincarnation. Does that mean that we're here in this life and we all have been reincarnated? We're new souls.
Okay, so it goes like this. Most people are not new souls. Most people are old souls. Right? Most of us are old souls. We've had, we've been here before. And I think that's very true. I mean, I see it in my children. My children have certain phobias. I cannot understand where they got it from. I have certain phobias that I don't know what. There's something mysterious about this phobia that I really feel is coming from a past life. However, the Ari says that during the redemptive times, which we are in, that new souls will come into the world. Now, these new souls haven't never been here before, meaning new soul relative to everybody else. Because we were all fibers in the original soul of the first man and woman. The women were fibers of the collective, the soul of Chava, and the men were the fibers of the soul of Adam. But Adam and Eve were not individuals. Adam and Eve were the universal humankind. Okay? And each and every one of us made that choice. Okay, each and every one has made that choice to eat of that tree as part of that original soul. Alright? And, you know, the Ari says, the soul, so to speak, correlates to the body. So some of us might be coming from that part of the soul that correlates to the fingers. Alright? And we might be just naturally brilliant artists. There's something about our very, you know, we're a body, but we're more a hand. You know what I mean? The hand becomes really our identity. And some of us might be coming from the mouth. Okay? You know, the correlation, the spiritual correlation to the mouth, and therefore, such people will probably have the gift of gab. And some people will come from the ear, and they'll have tremendous ability for hearing and whatever. And we'll all gravitate to some kind of role in the universe that actually correlates to a different part of our bodies, right? Which correlates to where originally we came from in the universal soul of the first man and woman. Now, so what is a new soul? A new soul is a soul that hasn't come into this world since the Garden of Eden. Right? And a lot of us are new souls. I haven't been here since that time.
What about at Mount Sinai?
Yes, we were all there. But we didn't come in, we weren't all there in body. We were all there in soul. That's what the Kabbalah and that's what the oral tradition says, that every single one of us were at Sinai, and therefore we have the ability to recognize the truth of Torah because we already encounter God. We already heard this.
But now, you know. I guess this is getting pretty technical, but are we individual souls that stay, have their individual identity as a separate soul, or is it sort of bits and pieces, and souls always come together and then bits and pieces come out and go into new lives?
Well, the truth is, it is bits and pieces. In other words, it could be that my neshama becomes reincarnated in Jack, And then my ruach, which is another part of myself, can become reincarnated. And there's going to be a combination of my spiritual characters that are being incarnated, reincarnated in different characters. In other words, they say that, let me get this straight, Cain was reincarnated into, let me get all three, I can't remember all three. Cain was reincarnated into the Egyptian that Moses killed. That's what the Ari teaches. And that was his nephesh. His nephesh ended up in this Egyptian that Moses ended up killing because this Egyptian was about to kill a Jew. And then his ruach, gee, I don't remember. Ooh. I can't remember what his ruach went into, but his neshama was reincarnated into Yitro, the father-in-law of Moses, who, by the way, was called Kaini. That was one of his names. One of his names was Kaini. So the Ari has a book called the Book of Reincarnation, which really goes through, I mean, when it kind of looks at the Torah from that point of view, and it starts telling you who was who, when, and then you start seeing these correlations in their lives, why this is happening to them, because that's what they happened in their last life, and that's what they need to go through as a fixing for what they went through then. It's really remarkable stuff. It's really remarkable stuff. Ultimately, the idea is that we all did hear. We, in terms of our neshamas, did hear. We did experience Sinai. And therefore, we can know this material in an intimate way and sense the truth and the applicability it has to our lives because we were there and we said we will do and we will listen. All right? But the idea is like this. What I wanted to explain is that, you know, the choice of life really is a choice between being an active, conscious partner in the process of history, consciously coordinating my life to the theme of life. And in so doing, I experience tremendous meaning, as we talked about the meaning of meaning. Meaning is when I fit, you know, I fit in the context of the sentence, the paragraph, the chapter, okay? And there's various levels of meaning whereby the word realizes how much it's really part of the sentence, chapter, the paragraph, chapter, the book, the volume, the set. You know, wow, that gives them that one word even more meaning. All right? And some words have succeeded in feeling part of a sentence but still haven't found themselves a paragraph, like a community, or a chapter, like a place to live, or a world, whatever. And so the meaning of meaning is coordinating myself. All right? Now, in some mysterious way, we will serve to fulfill the ultimate plan of God. That's what we're taught in Judaism. But the question is whether we'll serve in a way that we knew it and appreciated it, experienced it, and benefited the joy of the meaning of playing that role, or whether we'll simply be a victim of it. You know, example, just to get you to feel this, but it's not a completely accurate example, is let's say that you were brought into this world to somehow demonstrate the value of family. Right? That's, you know, that's the theme of your life. That's the attribute of God, so to speak, that you are playing out in the world. The value of love, but particularly family love, let's say. Okay, fine. Well, of course, what's going to happen is you'll be born into a situation which will be challenging family. Right? Because the challenge itself will enable you to demonstrate this incredible quality of life called family life. All right. So what happened is you're sitting there and you get a call from your boss. Hey, Jim, got a fantastic opportunity for you. We want to send you off to London to do a big business deal and you'll be away from the family, well, you know, just 2 weeks. So of course Jim now has a dilemma. Family, career, family, career, family, career. Right? Jim realizes, it's clear. It's absolutely clear. Family, family. Calls up his boss and says, when's the next plane? Because if I take that trip for 2 weeks, gee, imagine all the money I could make for the family. I mean, of course, only for the family, right? And, you know, I'm going to be able to buy my wife that which she wanted and my little son always, you know, and we can take that vacation. And, wow, it's all for, of course, just for the family. All right, comes back, doing really well. Family's a little put off. You know, he's been away for a while. But, okay, fine. We understand the sacrifice for the sake of the family. Of course, the boss calls up again. Hey, Jim, great news. You were a hit. We got to send you off. You're on a roll, man. All right, we're sending you off to Belgium. Okay? For a month, just a month. Jim, you're going to make $50,000 easy. Oh, now he's got this, wow, family. Family, career, family. Well, it's obvious. I mean, it's obvious, right? Family. Calls him up. When's the next plane? Because, of course, for family, what I could do with the $50,000 for the family, I mean, of course, only for the family, we could buy that house, we could get that swimming pool, we could, oh, it's all going to be great for the family. All right, comes back, now family's getting a little more tight, you know, wife's getting a little upset, you know. And then he gets another call, Jim, you know, he's sending off to Asia. Okay, 3 months, but gee, Jim, $3 million, and of course, once again, we all know the answer. It's only for the family, and off goes Jim to Asia. Okay. In the meantime, who knows, his kids are into drugs, his wife's fooling around with another man, who knows why? And in fact, Jim succeeded. He succeeded in clarifying the value of family by being such a horrible example of family. He taught the world the value of family. You see, there's different ways to do your job, to reveal the message, to clarify the quality of life that your neshama has come to this world to do. You could do it in one way, you could do it another way, but in the end you do it. Right? But you see the difference. You know, you see the major difference. And so too, that's just, you know, that's not exactly correct, but that gives you a sense how we will perform our work in this world. I mean, the Zohar goes so strong, the Zohar is very strong in this. The Zohar says that the soul has come into this world to become purified. Right? And there are various ways to become purified. There is purification through water. There's purification through fire. You know, if I have some kind of utensil and I need to purify it, it's not kosher. So sometimes it's through fire. Sometimes it's through boiling water. You know, there's various different ways. So the Zohar says something very strong. It says the neshama, the soul, the being, the human being has come to this world to become pure. And it's through water and fire. Now, Torah is referred to as water. And Torah is referred to as fire. And so if a person wants to, they can choose to take the path of purification through the water and fire of Torah. Right? But if a person chooses not, well then they will ultimately become pure through some other form of water and fire. But the soul, the being, the human being will come in this world and they will have to become pure. All right? That's a very frightening idea. That somehow what I've got to do, what I've got to work on in my life, I'm going to have to work on in my life. Okay? Whatever that particular dilemma is, whatever that particular spark of illumination that I'm responsible for, I'm responsible for. And how I'm going to do that, whether I'm going to do that willingly, whether I'm going to be an active partner in this process, or whether I'm somewhat going to be a victim of life situations that will force me to come to these realizations, that's ultimately my choice. Yes?
Fire and water are opposites, though.
I know,
but the Torah can be compared to both.
Right, they're different. They're opposite ways, but they're both refining. I mean, they're opposites, but they are both different approaches to you know, refining a utensil.
How does the soul become purified, not the Torah?
Well, through other, perhaps difficult situations in their lives, which they could have done. You know, it's the same idea, the same approach is. Also, it says, Adam la'amol yulad. A human being has been born into this world to work hard. Okay? So the oral tradition says, and so you can choose to either work hard at Torah or work hard at something else. Right? But you're going to have to work hard. And so you might as well choose doing it in Torah. That's the attitude of the Midrash. All right? But we've all come in this world with a certain fixing that we have to do. All right? And a tikkun. And we can choose the path. One will be more. One will be more fulfilling, you know. It will feel better. It will feel more direct. It will clearly plug me into the theme of life. I'll be aware of this fixing. And one, I'll be oblivious to it, and yet I'll be doing it anyways. But I lose out. And those around me lose out. Yes, David?
When you say Torah, because that word can mean a lot of different things.
Well, it means mitzvot. It means halakha. It means the study of Torah. It means the value of Torah. It means all that and more.
What about non-Jews?
Non-Jews? Well, you know, the Torah doesn't really talk so much about non-Jews, because it was written for the Jews. So, I assume that this is very similar for non-Jews. I mean, I know in their teachings, I know in Hindu thought or in Eastern thought, their attitude is that a person cannot go on until they've gone through all the zodiacs. Okay? And so you come into this world in Aries, And you ultimately know that you've hit your end of the road, ready to go on to the next world, when you become a Pisces. See you guys. I made it. Because Pisces is the end of the road. But you have to go through all the zodiacs according to Eastern thought. Okay, now I haven't seen that in Jewish thought, that you have to go through all the zodiacs. You have to be an Aries, you have to be a Libra, you have to be a this. All the Aries in the room say, what a long trip I've got to go, my gosh, oh no. Okay, so there's no source like that I've ever seen in Judaism. But I do know that in Eastern thought they say that. Okay? The same idea is like, you know, like who says that my eye is going to simply come in the form of David Aaron? My eye could come in the form of many others and probably has. I am not David Aaron, but I am playing David Aaron. This life. Okay? This life. And my next life, which I hope will be playing in the next world, but if not, if I'm back here, so I might be playing another character. But that character will be in a situation with various kinds of character traits, which was essential for what I needed to internalize from this world, which I didn't succeed, unfortunately, in doing in my last life career, my last character. But there's various characters that the Neshama, play. And I played a couple of characters. Right, many masters, many lives. But really, it's not many masters. There's only one master and many lives.
Do you remember things from the past lives?
Can we remember things?
Yeah.
Well, it could be these past life regression stuff. Could help. I don't know if it's reliable. Okay, I do know there are Kabbalists that have this ability to look at you and tell you, you know, a history. But is that what you should be doing? No.
No,
you shouldn't be doing that. You should just play your role. You should just play your role. You know, if this is who you are in this life, then be it. But to get involved with, well, who was I in my last life? And that interfere with fully playing who you're supposed to play in this life, it's a major mistake. It's a major mistake.
No, because you know, shouldn't do it. Meditation, like right under our nose.
Right.
Doesn't the angel give this to us, like, right when we're born? Because it's supposed they teach you the Torah when you're in your mother's womb.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the Midrashic way of saying that the soul knows the entire Torah. And it comes into this world to make it real. You might know something, but, you know, it's like learning halakha, but never having a real halakhic crisis to really realize that halakha. So the soul knows the entire Torah. And that's brought into a world full of crises, right? So that Torah really becomes, you know, something very real, something very internal, and something that you're truly deeply conscious of and appreciate. Because you've been put into real practical halakhic situations, right? But there's some people that aren't going to deal with those situations as halakhic situations at all. And therefore, Torah says, then you will not access what your soul came into this world to access. You know. You see, ultimately, the particular activity is the mitzvot and the halakha. We've learned that the halakha is a path. It enables you to coordinate your particular path to the universal path, to the path of history, to the theme of life. So you can be coordinated, all right? It's a directive. It's not just simply goody-goody boy points and you did it and you did it and you're collecting them, saving them, all right? And that's really what mitzvot are all about. How I play my role in the symphony. How I take directions from the conductor, right? And in so doing, I merge with that conductor. I don't become the conductor. But the conductor and the violin player just have such an intense connection, all right? And that's very exciting. The question is, what are the principles of organization? Alright. Now whatever those principles of organization are, they will be determined by what? The theme. Okay? The theme will determine the appropriate principles which will govern the movement of life. Okay? And so the question really is, we're kind of skipping over here just because I got 15 minutes. The theme is essential to clarify. And that theme is going to, so to speak, determine the principles which will guide the behavior. Now remember, these principles are going to guide our lives, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not. Our choice is to coordinate our lives to those principles. Right? In other words, the advantage of knowing the principle of gravity is that I now can accord myself to it. It would be pretty stupid to go against the principles of gravity. Okay, not knowing that such a principle exists made it very difficult for life. Okay, but once we know there is a principle called the force of gravity, now I can accord myself to it. Now I can, in fact, learn how to make it work for me, how to help it. You know. Now gravity doesn't become a downer, so to speak, doesn't inhibit my. But maybe I can use the force of gravity to move things, to direct things, right?
And so the principles will be a direct function of the theme. Now the question is, what's the theme?
And the most important question is to know that there is a theme. Right? Now this is something that, you know, everybody's looking for something, generally. Question is, where do we find a theme to life? Is science going to give us a theme to life? Science doesn't really consider itself or concern itself with the whys. Why this, why that? Science categorizes and describes the behavior of life. That's what science does. Religion, on the other hand, there's no conflict, because religion is dealing with, well, why are things like this? What's the purpose of it? What's the theme of it? All right. Now we need to have some kind of understanding of the theme of life. That is probably the most important question of your life. Why? Because if you don't know the theme of your life, how can you know if what you're doing is progress or what you're doing is regress?
But what you mean by theme is goal.
What?
Science in general wouldn't be progressing if they didn't ask why.
But they don't. They don't really ask why. They don't ask what is life for. What's the purpose of life? That doesn't direct what they're discovering, right? They're discovering, they're examining, they're, you know, they're in an honorable way, though, you know, a respectful way. I say they're playing around with life. You know, when I put this with that, what does it do? When I do this, what does it do? Right? But it's not like the scientist really is preoccupied, well, what's the purpose of life? What's this all about? All right? Now you have to understand how dangerous that really is.
You mean theme as a goal, like what is our goal in life?
Yes, but goal sounds like something futuristic. Theme enables you to see how the goal influences every present moment. Every present moment is contributing to this all-encompassing theme. Okay?
How will we ever know it?
Well, Judaism claims that we do know it through revelation, through Torah. Okay? But what I first want you to understand is the importance of knowing it. Right? Without a theme, without a sense of the purpose, then you don't know if what you're doing is fixing or destroying. I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a car, but you don't know what a car is for. Okay? So let's say you mistakenly think it's really for washing clothing. Right? I mean, you know, you're just a little frazzled today, and you didn't know what a car was. And so you think, well, it's for clothing. So you open up the door, and you start throwing your dirty laundry into it. Okay? And then you close the door and try to figure out how to get the water into the cabin. Well, what you see is you notice that, wait a second, something's wrong with this washing machine. Because the water is spraying on the outside, on the window of it. And this is absolutely bizarre. So you realize, gee, something's wrong with this thing. So you take it, you rewire it, so that the water starts pouring into the cabin. Right? And of course, we realize you just destroyed your car. You know, someone walks in, you know, what are you doing to my car? You're like, what do you mean car? I'm washing my clothing in it. What else? What would you do with a car? Okay? So we understand how absurd that would be, that if I had no understanding what a car is for, then how would I know if what I'm doing is fixing it or perhaps destroying it? Whether what I'm doing is enhancing it or maybe diminishing it. How could I know? All right? Do you follow this? Now, we all know what a car is for. We know that a car is for transportation. All right? Now, if a person makes a mistake and thinks that a car is for status, well, how dangerous a car could be, right? I made a mistake. Cars are for transportation. So what you really want to make sure is this car can get you from point A to point B safely. So therefore, your considerations in terms of buying a car will be, you know, what works better, okay? What's safer? What has a smoother ride? Okay? But if you don't really have that, you somehow, okay, I know that cars are transportation, but you really made a mistake. Because inside, you're really buying a car not for transportation, okay? Because you actually were doing very well with the buses, but you really bought a car because of some static symbol. You know, look at me. Right? So now, your concerns will be very different. What will you look for in a car? Well, you're not looking for a car to provide transportation, but you're looking a style, color, trim line, and you might in fact forfeit some basic needs for safe transportation in light of this car filling your ego, right? And so if you buy yourself a red racing car, so don't be surprised that your insurance goes up, Because they know why you're buying a car, alright? And they have a sense, like, oh, you know. So, in other words, you see that the considerations that we take in our lives, in terms of purchasing something, changes dramatically. Dramatically. Now, anybody who's going to invest a tremendous amount of money in a car, which is basically what it is today, it's a lot of money. So you research real well, don't you? Okay? You want to make sure that you know what you're doing. Right? You want to have a good understanding of what a car is, how it works, and how it can best perform the intended purpose of transportation and getting from point A to point B without dying on the way. Makes sense, right? Person's going to buy themselves a computer. So they know what a computer's for. If they don't know what a computer's for, but they're buying because everybody else is buying one, okay? So they're going to probably waste a tremendous amount of money, even more so a tremendous amount of time, okay? And they'll end up with something that really does not serve their needs. But they came into the store with an absolute wrong understanding of what it's for. What do I need? And maybe if it was a good salesman, he might show you, you don't need this. I mean, based on what you're telling me, okay, if all you're looking for is somewhere to store, you know, telephone numbers, well, this is just going to complicate your life. You're spending a tremendous amount of money. You don't need this. And not only that, but you're going to be worried someone could steal it. You're going to have to buy insurance. You don't need this. Okay? So, isn't it interesting how when it comes to things like cars or computers or other things that we buy, we are willing to invest a tremendous amount of time, effort, to make sure that we're doing it right. I mean, we wouldn't want to buy ourselves a computer that we just spent maybe $15,000 on, or even $3,000 on, and then just not be careful to understand, well, what's it for, and how do I work it, and how can I make sure that I keep it in running order, and not damage it, okay? It would also be pretty rare that a person would invest money in a, let's say, a computer, and not read the instructions, the directions, you know, and figure out and say, oh, gee, you know, I have no patience for any directions. Who the hell is this guy to tell me how to run a computer? I'll figure it out on my own. You know, and just turn it on and start banging away and doing this and doing that and finding yourself with a broken computer. Because you simply didn't follow directions. Okay? And that's a certain impatience. Why would I do that? Well, it's the same thing with life. Why do people think that life in any way deserves less attention than that? Why is it that I'll be willing to take a course in this and that and that and this, invest a tremendous amount of money, but when it comes to a course that clarifies what's the purpose of life, or what perhaps is the purpose of life, because unless I can clarify what the purpose of life is, then there's no way of knowing if what I'm doing is helping it or destroying it. Right? There's absolutely no way of knowing. Okay? And that's the strange thing about people. They, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't know what the purpose of life was. I had no theme to life. But there's one thing that I knew. I need money. Whatever life is all about, I certainly need money to get there. And I think that's the attitude of a lot of people. A lot of people don't know what the theme of life is, the purpose of life. They've never even asked. They don't even know who to ask. Okay? But one thing they're sure, whatever the purpose of life is, it needs money. And so therefore, I know I'm not wasting my time because at least I'm getting a job that will make money. But the truth is that I could be wasting a tremendous amount of time because maybe I don't need as much money as I thought when I really know that the best things in life are for free. Okay? And that what I'm really doing in this world, and, you know, a person is making a living, but they're not living a living. And they haven't even had a chance to figure out, well, what am I doing here? What's it all about? Now, maybe you won't find an answer, but gee, it seems to be the most important thing to clarify. What is the purpose of my life? What am I trying to accomplish? What is the theme? Is there a theme to me? Is there a theme to all of life? If there is, that would be better, because then I would like to coordinate my theme to it. The ultimate theme. You know, I was working in this youth organization, and I had a lot of problems, tremendous amount of difficulties in getting them excited about Jewish things, so I stopped trying, right? I got them excited about non-Jewish things, okay? Meaning what? I would tell the group, I would come into a group, and I say, listen, I got a great idea. I'd like to bring in, you know, a PLO speaker. Right? I remember I did this with one group, and they were shocked. Because I was the rabbi, the Judaism specialist, with his beanie on his head, and I'm coming in, and I'm saying, I want to bring in a PLO speaker. So they like to bring in a PLO speaker. So they said, yeah, yeah? So I remember one kid going to me, well, aren't they our enemies? I said, yeah. Right. At least in those days they were. Okay, and yeah, right. So I said, well, why would we want to hear one of our enemies speak? Aren't they out to destroy the Jewish people? I said, yeah. So I said, do you want to hear a rabbi? No. I said, well, wouldn't this be exciting? Yeah. And so I brought in a PLO speaker who happened to be a yeshiva guy that I had dressed up as a PLO speaker. All right, it went very well. Well, it went so well, I had another one. I'll tell you that story another time. But this story is more interesting for what we're talking about. I went to another group of people, and I said, listen, I'd like to do something really exciting. I'd like to bring in the Jews for Jesus. So I went, what? Aren't we a Jewish organization? I said, yes. Would you like me to be a rabbi? No. I said, well, wouldn't this be interesting, a Jews for Jesus? Let's see if he can convince us about Jesus. Wouldn't that be fun? Yeah! It's a great idea! I got really excited. Everyone's talking about it. Everybody showed up to this program. You know, if I would have brought in a rabbi, nobody show up. Bring in a Jews for Jesus. Now that's something I'd like to hear. So we did it in the home of one of the kids. We get to the home, and the father of the home comes up to me and says, Rabbi, I want to thank you. Thank you. My kid has been in this organization for years, and rarely has he done anything meaningful. But finally, a meaningful program, you've invited Jews to Jesus to my house. Thank you very much. I looked at the guy like, sure, buddy. anything to assimilate your kid. Just ask me. I mean, it was the weirdest thing. Crazy. And then he asked me, could he join? I said to me, I never wanted to participate in any of these programs, but this sounds exciting. Wow, a real life Jews for Jesus. Wow. Sure, why not, mister? Go ahead. No problem. So, of course, I brought in a yeshiva boy. Who else would I bring in? So I went back to the yeshiva that was teaching at night, and I said to this guy that I'm going to bring in a Jews for Jesus. He said, where are you going to get Jews for Jesus? I said, anybody tell you that your eyes are very glassy? And that you look a little spacey? And he said, what do you mean? I said, yes, you'll be my Jews for Jesus. And I said, no, I'm not. Anyway, so I got myself a Jews for Jesus. Now, we had the whole thing worked out. We had the whole thing staged. Of course, I'm not going to teach these kids about Jesus. But I knew that they'll listen to him, but they won't listen to me. So you know what he was going to do? He was going to get up in front of these teenagers. I mean, we're talking about 16, 17, 18, okay? So these are really not even kids. I mean, these are, you know, supposed to be adults. And so he gets up and starts telling them how now that he found Jesus, he loves Shabbos. And he starts talking about Shabbos. And these kids are, Shabbos. Because he's talking, if I would tell about Shabbos, they wouldn't listen to a word I have to say. You know, but he starts telling about, now that I believe in Jesus, I got a shul, I eat kosher. He starts telling about the meaning of kosher. He starts telling the meaning about Shabbos. It was unbelievable. It was a total class in Judaism, but they would never have listened to it from me. But this guy saying, wow, I'm so proud to be a Jew. And they throw in, you know, now I believe in Jesus. Okay? But of course, now I have to deprogram him. Okay? On stage. So we had this all worked out. I'm going to deprogram this guy. And I'm going to ask him, we had this all worked out on the way up to this thing. You gotta understand, I had to let him out of the car a block away so he shows up. And so we're on our way up there. And so this is what we're going to do. And this is the way it went. Okay? He's talking about, you know, Judaism, Kashrut, and Shabbos, and all these things. And then he throws in a little bit, you know, and now I believe in Jesus, I'm really proud of being Jewish. Then I say to him, excuse me, can I ask you a question? He says, yeah, sure. I said, would you like to buy my car? So the guy says, excuse me, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I'm in the middle with this group here talking about Jesus, you know? And I said, I know, but please, could you just answer the question? Are you looking to buy a car? I noticed that you walked over here, and I saw that you didn't drive up. Well, he says, well, in fact, I am, but can we talk about it after? I said, no, just give me a second. Are you interested in buying? I'd like to sell you my car. So the guy says, okay, I'd be interested in looking at it. But can we talk about it after? I said, no. I'd like you to buy my car, and it only cost you, like $5,000. Okay? Will you buy it? So he says, no. I don't buy it. I mean, I'd like to take a look at it. I said, okay, you can see it just from the window. You see it over there? That one, the blue one? Right. Will you buy it? He says, no, I can't buy it. I mean, I'll just look at it. I mean, I'd like to take it for a drive. I said, okay, we'll get into it and take it around the block once, and then, you know, please buy it. So he says, no, I couldn't do that. I mean, I'd want to take it to an expert. I mean, I don't know that much about cars. I mean, I want to take it to a person who really understands cars. I said, oh, okay. By the way, how did you get into Jesus again? Right? He says, what are you talking about? I said, well, how did you get into Jesus? Well, I was walking down the street and I met this guy and he showed me this Bible. And he showed me some verses. I said, you mean ones that were underlined in yellow? Yeah, right. And then what did you do? And then I went to some classes. Oh, yeah, and then what did you do? Right? I said, did you ever take it to an expert? Did you ever ask a rabbi what he thinks about this? Did you ever, and I'm going on and on and on, and this guy starts to cry. It was great. We did such a wonderful, he says, you don't really, give me a chance. You know, and he's going off, and then we're doing this whole, we had this all staged out. The kids were freaking out because they didn't know what was going on. And then the finale of this whole show that we put on is he starts screaming, "Jesus saves! Jesus saves!" And he runs out of the house, right? All right, and we were going to tell them this whole joke. But anyways, what happens? He runs out of the house, and the father of the house runs after him and begs him to come back and apologizes for that mean rabbi who had the audacity to do that, and it's not fair of that rabbi. And my friend's going, "Lay off, mister. Give me," and the guy's grabbing, "Please, I won't let you leave my house. You know, hospitality is a very important Jewish principle," and he's grilling this guy who in his mind is a Jew for Jesus after he has kids. It was bizarre. Anyways, in the end, they told them what we did, and then they loved us even more because we're actors. Wow. We're really impressed with you. You're actors, you know, wow. Did you do any theater before? Anyways, that was the way it went. Crazy world. The point is like this. How is it that people simply don't take the time, and it's not going to take one day or a week, or even 3 weeks or 6 weeks, to really explore and internalize and understand, so what is the theme of life? You know, I mean, unless you come up with that answer, then there's no way of knowing anything you're doing is really productive. And most probably, it could very well be destructive, because you have no understanding. Well, what am I trying to do? I can't just leave it to hope and luck and figure out, someday I'll figure this out. This is something that really deserves serious thought. Now, Judaism has a very real understanding of the theme of life, a real understanding of the purpose of life, and how one fulfills that. And that's what we're going to do in the next class.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.